You are listening to the American Military History Podcast, Episode 6. Today we're talking about the Siege of Boston and the capture of Fort Ticonderoga. This is part 5 of our series on the Revolutionary War. Hey everybody, I'm your host Justin, welcoming you to the American Military History Podcast. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for giving the podcast a try. This podcast is produced every week, and show notes and photos are found at www.AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com. Come back often, and please feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS reader or subscribe on iTunes. You can also follow me on Twitter at AMHPodcast and look us up on Facebook. Now, let's get into the episode. At the end of our last episode, we had British Brigadier General Percy marching his regulars back into Boston, and they were licking their wounds from that day's encounters at Concord and Lexington. Now there, the troops had been under the command of Major Pitcairn and Lieutenant Colonel Smith. All of these troops arrived in Charlestown late on April 18th, and on the morning of April 19th, we see the reaction of the militiamen in the area, and almost 15,000 had marched and converged on Boston. Now, we have seen this before. If you'll recall, when we discussed the powder alarm, we saw troops marching on Boston, but they later dispersed. But here we see something a little bit different. We see a larger force, and also blood has been spilt at this point. If you'll recall the powder alarm, it was a misunderstanding. People thought that shots had been fired and people had been killed, but it actually wasn't true. On the morning of the 19th, these soldiers know that, yes, something has actually happened. The troops were there to stay, so much so that their positioning and the duration of their stay is referred to as the Siege of Boston, and it lasted almost one full year from April 19, 1775 to March 17, 1776. When the troops arrived on the 19th, they were under the loose leadership of Brigadier General William Heath, but by the 20th, command had been given to General Artemas Ward. Ward was to become a major general in the Revolutionary War and a congressman from Massachusetts. John Adams, as second U.S. president, would say of Ward, "He was universally esteemed, beloved, and confided in by his army and his country." Ward was born in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, as the sixth of seven children. His father was a sea captain, merchant, lawyer, land developer, farmer, and a jurist. He attended common school with his brothers and sisters, and later went on to graduate from Harvard in 1748. He spent a brief bit of time teaching at Harvard, and then achieved his first public office in 1751 as a township assessor for Worcester County. Ward's military service began in 1755 with the French and Indian War. Ward was made a major and eventually a colonel in the 3rd Regiment, where he served with garrison forces along western Massachusetts. In 1774, favoring rebellion, the local militia forces, under direction from a local committee of safety, designated Ward as the general and commander-in-chief of the Shrewsbury Militia. Now, during the Revolutionary War, we would see him as a major general, second in command only to George Washington. He was one of the original 4 major generals in the army, along with Charles Lee, Philip Schuyler, and Israel Putnam. Ward and Heath had deployed their roughly 15,000 militiamen around Boston, and they deployed their troops in such a way that it effectively cut Boston off from land traffic. They had a siege line that extended from Chelsea, around the peninsulas of Boston and Charlestown, all the way down to Roxbury. And they concentrated their forces around the Charlestown Neck, which was the only land access to Charleston, and the Boston Neck, which was, at the time, the only land access to Boston. And at this point, British control extended only into the towns, the harbor, and sea around the Boston area. General Thomas Gage spoke about the militiamen gathering outside of Boston, and he said, "The rebels are not as despicable rabble too many have supposed them to be. In all their wars against the French, they never showed such conduct, attention, and perseverance as they do now." Gage had turned his focus on fortifying his position, focusing at first on the easily defensible ones. At Roxbury in the south, he ordered lines of defense with 10 24-pound guns. In Boston, 4 hills on the approach and inside the city were fortified. This was the main defensive elements of the city. Gage also makes the decision to abandon Charlestown. He pulls all of his forces out, including the forces who had fought at Lexington and Concord, This leaves the town vacant of British troops, as well as the highlands near it, which included Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill. While Boston was the somewhat of a pro-British stronghold in the Massachusetts colony, it didn't mean that 100% of the population of the city were pro-British. In fact, there were a good number of patriots inside the city when the siege began. Enough patriots to make Gage fearful of weapons being smuggled into the city. Now at first, to combat this, the traffic into and out of Boston was severely restricted. Now what that means is the British forces inside of Boston were restricting the people coming in and going out, and the colonial forces were also doing the same thing. Now eventually the two sides reached an agreement that would allow traffic up through the Boston Neck, provided that no firearms were carried. Loyalist Boston residents acquired and turned in almost 2,000 muskets, and we see most of the patriots who are still in the city by this point start to leave. Now conversely, most of the loyalists, so the pro-British supporters, who had lived outside of the city, left their country homes and estates and fled into the city of Boston. Many felt it was just not safe to live outside the city. Now some of these men in turn joined the loyalist regiments in Boston, which were attached to the British Army. At the point the siege started in April, we don't officially have a Continental Army formed yet. That would come a few months later. So what we have are various militia units working together. And because of that too, there's really no official and formal Continental Navy. And, well, the main reason for that is they really didn't possess a lot of ships that were armed. And so because of all this, the siege did not extend to the sea. So Boston Harbor was open to receive supplies sailed in primarily from Nova Scotia, and the colonial militiamen, they had to accept this as, you know, it's Great Britain's Navy, which was one of the largest navies and one of the most supreme navies of the time, and they dominated the waters. But even with the supplies from Nova Scotia, British forces were short on rations, which forced prices in Boston up. With prices on the rise, the population of Boston was more willing to accept money from the colonials in exchange for information about what was going on inside the town. This leads to the American forces typically having very strong intelligence about what was going on inside of Boston, while General Gage had little to no effective knowledge of what his enemy was doing. As I said, the siege of Boston lasted almost a year, and it was an ongoing affair. And while it was going on, there were several other events that took place. So we're going to pause talking about the siege of Boston, and don't worry, we'll come back to it. But we're going to now talk about a few things that happened in May of 1775. So on May 3rd, the Massachusetts Provincial Congress authorized Benedict Arnold, yes, the Benedict Arnold, who would later defect to the British, to raise forces for taking Fort Ticonderoga near the southern end of Lake Champlain in the province of New York. The fort was extremely useful to the British as a supply and communication link between Canada and New York, but most important to the colonials, it occupied a strategic location that overlooked the potential invasion route that the British would have to take down from Canada towards Lake Champlain into the Hudson River Valley and ultimately onto New York City. If the British took New York, they would have then split the New England colonies from the southern colonies, and using this approach, they could focus on dealing with one isolated segment at a time. The fort also contained heavy artillery, which was in short supply to the colonial militia units. So Arnold left for the fort with a small contingent of men, not enough to fight, mostly aides and a few soldiers. His mission was to raise the local militia forces in the area and command them to take the fort. Now, while he was traveling to Ticonderoga, another patriot by the name of Ethan Allen was planning his own raid on the fort. Now, Allen was a farmer, businessman, land speculator, philosopher, writer, patriot, and politician. And he's best known as one of the founders of the state of Vermont and for the capture of Fort Ticonderoga. But wait, didn't I just say that Benedict Arnold was sent to capture the fort? Absolutely I did, but so was Allen. In late April, following the battles of Lexington and Concord, Allen received a message from members of the Connecticut militia unit that were planning to capture the fort. Now Allen, either fueled by his patriotism or hoping to improve his political position, or maybe both, begin rounding up the Green Mountain Boys. On May 2nd, 60 men from Massachusetts and Connecticut met with Allen, where they talked through logistics and strategy of the operation. By May 7th, these men and 130 others joined with Allen at Castleton. The morning of the 8th, Allen was elected to lead the operation, and he and his Green Mountain boys planned to raid the fort at dawn on May 10th. Now, Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys were not, in fact, a country music act. The Green Mountain Boys were nothing more than a collection of militia units from the territory between the British provinces of New York and New Hampshire. And this piece of land here was referred to as the New Hampshire Grants, and that would later become the state of Vermont. So again, just to lay out how these dates line up for you. The morning of May 8th, Allen is selected to lead the operation to take Fort Ticonderoga. Now, on the afternoon of May 9th, Benedict Arnold arrives, unexpectedly, and claimed he was to command a mission to capture the fort. So, of course, the Green Mountain Boys took this as you would expect, and stated that they would only follow Allen into battle, not Arnold. The two men, Allen and Arnold, both knew that taking the fort was an important piece of the Colonials' military strategy. So they stepped away to have a private discussion, and they determined that they would both, quote-unquote, lead, or at least both of them would be at the front of the troops when the attack was made. Prior to Arnold's arrival, Allen had dispatched two small companies to procure boats for the men to travel across to the fort. Now, the attack plan called for the men to cross over to the fort from Hands Cove in Shoreham. Now, around 2 a.m. on the scheduled morning of the raid, the men were finally able to find boats and begin the crossing. Only 83 of all the men that had been gathered together crossed over before Allen and Arnold became worried that dawn was approaching. The two men decided to attack the fort with only the 83 men that they had. The men marched towards the fort with its capture on their mind. Now, unknown to the men marching towards it, the fort itself was not heavily guarded or even in that great of shape. After the British captured it back from the French in 1759, they did minor improvements from 1759 to 1760, but allowed it to fall into disrepair after that. Colonel Frederick Haldimand, who commanded the fort in 1773, wrote that it was in ruinous condition. The fort was garrisoned with 48 soldiers and roughly 25 women and children. The lone sentry on duty of the fort that night was no doubt surprised to see 80 men, led by Arnold and Allen, marching towards the fort. The two men marched their troops in and went directly to the fort commander's quarters. Lieutenant Jocelyn Feltham was the assistant to the fort's commander, and he was awoken by the noise of all the men coming in. And Feltham stalled while the fort's commander, Captain William Delaplace, dressed. When the captain had dressed, he emerged from his chambers and surrendered his sword to Allen. The rest of the British men in the fort surrendered peacefully with no shots fired. Allen's a very interesting character, and he has a lot of things that he claimed he said or that he claimed happened. And I'm going to share them with you in the sense of this is what Allen said, not necessarily that this is true history. So Allen claimed that as they were waiting on Captain Delaplace, he yelled to him, "Come out, you old rat." And also, while again waiting for Delaplace, Feltham had asked under what authority it was that Allen was there to seize the fort. Allen stated that he proclaimed, rather loudly, "In the name of the great Jehovah and the Continental Congress." And then the last thing that Allen claimed is that Delaplace did not come out fully dressed to present his sword, but he came out holding his breeches and sword in hand. It essentially means he came out of his bedchambers with no pants on, holding his sword, and surrendered the fort. Capturing the fort gave the colonial militias a large supply of cannons and other arms, much of which Henry Knox transported back to Boston during the winter of 1775 to 1776. In fact, these very cannon were instrumental to later ending the siege of Boston, but we'll talk about that more later. Now, just to mention Knox very briefly, if any of my listeners are in the armed forces and you have been stationed in Fort Sill in Oklahoma, there's a place there called Knox Hall, named after him. He's also had two forts named after him, Fort Knox in Kentucky, most people have heard about that one, and Fort Knox in Maine. He also served as the very first United States Secretary of War. Benedict Arnold remained in control of the fort until 1,000 Connecticut troops under the command of Benjamin Hindman arrived in June 1775. Arnold never got the word that Hindman was coming to take command, and after a delegation from Massachusetts arrived to clear up the matter, Arnold resigned his commission and departed, leaving the fort in Hindman's hands. Now, on May 10th, as Arnold and Allen were taking Fort Ticonderoga, The Second Continental Congress came together, and it was actually more of a reconvening of the First Continental Congress. And as I said when we talked about the first one, both of these Continental Congresses are important pieces of history. There were a lot of things that took place here that were important to the founding of our country. However, since the scope of the podcast is to tell the history of America through military, we're not going to talk too deeply about it. But I do want to talk about one of the resolutions that they made on June 14th. Seeing a need to greater coordinate their military efforts against the British, the Congress decided to form what was called the Continental Army, and this was the first official standing army of the Americas. Now, while the Continental Army would have its own troops, it would also be supplemented by local militias and troops that remained under the control of individual states or were otherwise independent. Now, on June 15th, General George Washington was named Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. And that leads us to our next episode, where we'll start a series that we'll come back to throughout the course of the podcast, and that's a series called Presidents Who Served. We're going to spend some time talking about George Washington and what his military career looked like. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to see any of the pictures of the content discussed here, make sure you check my website, www.AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com. If you'd like to be notified when new episodes are released, you can subscribe through iTunes, Facebook, or Twitter. We also have a YouTube channel where you can listen to the episodes on YouTube. The links to all of those are on the website. If you'd like to support this podcast, visit the donate page of the website.